bloodbath. Trump leans into violent rhetoric and posts attacks on the judge's family.
He's either whacked out or dishonest.
While Biden brings up the heavy hitters,
all the things he's doing are so old.
Ahead of a showdown in the Midwest.
This particular issue is breaking our coalition.
Plus, Good's grief.
This is where we will make our stand.
A Republican primary gets personal.
Nobody cares what Marjorie Taylor Greene says or thinks.
My opponent wants to burn it all down, no solution kind of guy.
New reporting on the GOP's civil war.
Why are you targeting Bob Good? You don't need to run away.
Will it knock them out of power in November?
In primaries, people fall in love. In the general election, they fall in line.
And out of the shadows.
The next thing you know, CNN's showing up.
We catch up with Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows.
Can I ask you about your grand jury testimony?
Inside Politics, the best reporting from inside the corridors of power, starts now.
Good morning. Welcome to Inside Politics Sunday. Happy Easter. I'm Manu Raju. Now, as Donald Trump prepares to make history in about 2 weeks as the first ex-president to stand trial in a criminal case, this weekend he's keeping up his attacks on the New York judge overseeing the proceedings. Now, remember, he's accused of allegedly falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to keep an alleged extramarital affair with adult film actress Stormy Daniels silent in the run-up to the 2016 election. And even as he's facing a gag order limiting what he can say about witnesses in the case, and despite new warnings from one federal judge that such attacks are deeply damaging to the system of justice, he is still going after Judge Juan Merchan and his daughter, as he did again on his social media platform just yesterday, and to Fox News last night, claiming that he is the victim.
It's a shame that it has to take place. This is, again, third world country stuff, whether it's borders or whether it's this. They've weaponized the Department of Justice. They've weaponized the FBI. They raided my house. They find nothing. Look how well I'm doing.
Now, this all comes as Trump is trying to gin up his base as he ratchets up his dark rhetoric, sharing a video depicting Joe Biden tied up in the back of a Trump supporter's pickup truck. Now, Biden campaign spokesman saying, quote, Trump is regularly inciting political violence and it's time people take him seriously. And as Trump's legal woes are hurting his ability to keep pace with Biden in fundraising, 2 days from now, Trump is holding a rally in Michigan. And that is his first visit to a swing state since he locked up the nomination nearly 3 weeks ago. He's billing that Michigan speech as, quote, remarks on Biden's border bloodbath. Now, that's after he drew criticism for using that same word during a different rally a couple weeks back. Now, the Michigan event is planned for just days after a 25-year-old woman was killed there, allegedly by a man she had been dating and who immigration authorities say was in the U.S. illegally. And that's according to our Grand Rapids affiliate, Fox 17. Now, Democrats like Michigan Senate candidate Alyssa Slotkin say Trump is exploiting a heinous act.
That's the thing that is just so gruesome about this is that you have a terrible murder of a young woman. And then you have the president former president coming in and saying, you know, we it's all about the border and border security, but he won't let us actually deal with the border. So that's what's frustrating to a lot of us. And him and his allies, including people I'm running against, are using it as a political issue, not that they care for this particular woman.
All right, we have a great panel to break down all of this. Jackie Kucinich from the Boston Globe, Semaphore's Dave Weigel, and Rhonda Colvin of the Washington Post. Good morning. Happy Easter for all those who celebrate. Thanks for joining early this morning. Look, we are getting into week four of essentially the general election, you know, moving ahead here. Trump is clearly been sidetracked by all these criminal cases. He has not done any campaign rallies in swing states. This is his first visit coming up on Michigan on Tuesday. He is attacking this judge in the social media post from a couple of days ago, going after the daughter of this judge and doing things to rile up the base. I mean, what do we make of Trump's general election strategy? Because it is not a pivot to the center. It is dealing with his legal problems and painting himself as a victim.
It sounds a lot like his general election strategy the last time. It really does try to hone this vitriol trying to direct his supporters at this judge. We've seen him do this since 2016 at judges that have been handling his various legal issues.
Of course, now he's facing criminal charges.
Exactly. It's very different. Of course, that was a civil situation. But yeah, exactly. So it feels even more acute. It's not going to stop. And I think what this could have, I mean, there's one thing to do this in a Republican primary. To do this in a general election with the consistency that he has, he could end up reminding voters why they turned their back on him in the first place, the last election.
It's definitely a risk, but is any of this working? Just to look at some of the polls. There was some out from Fox News and Quinnipiac poll, the two national polls out this week. Fox poll shows that Trump is still leading with independents. Of course, independents are going to be absolutely critical, as they always are in elections, but in particular in this close election, which we expect. 5 points he's beating Joe Biden by nationally. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. pulling in 12% of the vote nationally. Immigration is a top issue among independent voters, Republican voters we've seen, but independent voters, that is tied with the economy. 23%, according to the Quinnipiac poll. Do you think, is this Trump rhetoric on immigration, as he's going to do in Michigan on Tuesday, is it speaking to those voters?
Yes, and with bloodbath, the term that is coming up that he's using, this is something that the Biden campaign tried to turn against him. It's something Trump's team immediately started using on their own, saying that we are going to stop the border bloodbath. Overall, the campaigns are in this position. The Biden campaign would like you to think of how things were four years ago, and the Trump campaign would like you to think of how things were 5 years ago. Mm. And 5 years ago, the overall argument is, yes, there were mean tweets, there were attacks on judges specifically, there were all sorts of things that the media, people like us, were obsessed with, but didn't you feel better? And the Biden campaign, anything that's successful for them, if you look at the rhetoric from their fundraiser in New York on this week, anything that's successful for them is bring it back to how bad the economy actually was 4 years ago, not five. Anything else that Trump does that seems like a distraction, that burns up the news cycle, it doesn't really hurt Trump, because people have processed. When he was president, certain things felt like I didn't have to pay attention to. Some things he said that sounded crazy, but I wasn't as worried about the border. I wasn't as worried about inflation. That's the entire Trump message. So he can have a week that looks like a waste, where he's talking about other topics. Mm-hmm. From his perspective, it's, remember when I was president, yeah, and you were talking about other topics, but you weren't worried about immigration?
And to suck up all the oxygen, yeah, right? And what's so fascinating and probably alarming, and it is certainly to some Democrats, and we'll see for the Biden campaign, they say, look, it's too early for the polls. Voters will make their decisions as they get closer. Certainly polls will change. We'll see if they ultimately do. But there are certainly warning signs, particularly among some of the key demographic groups that were central for Joe Biden's victory. Look at what the Fox poll says about where Biden and Trump are with Black and Hispanic voters. 71%, yeah, sure, Biden is winning here with Black voters. Hispanic voters, he is losing. And that is actually consistent with the Quinnipiac poll says nationally Biden is also down 3 points with Hispanic voters. Very similar in those two polls on that question, Black and Latino voters. But the exit polls from 2020 just shows you how much ground Biden has lost with those two key voting blocks. Black voters, where he won by 87-12 back in 2020. Latino voters, 65%. He is now losing with those voters. What explains that, and what does the Biden campaign have to do differently?
I think we're still trying to figure out what explains that, but we do know this is part of a trend that we did see back in the last election, where the former President Trump did well with Black voters, specifically Black men and Latino men. So it appears that he's still trying to capitalize on that, trying to build that support. But I would actually like to look a little bit more under the hood on those numbers with Black voters and Hispanic voters, specifically women. Black women often outvote Black men, as well as most women across race usually outvote male voters. So you have to wonder, especially with the abortion issue becoming such a salient issue with most voters, if that's going to play into the Black support and the Black vote and the Hispanic vote as well. You've got to factor in how women in those blocks are also voting and how they feel. And right now, polling does suggest that they're still following President Biden.
Yeah, and look, one thing that Biden team has going for him is money. They've been mm-hmm. fundraising mm-hmm. and dealing with the like. Trump is dealing with his legal woes and spending money on his legal problems, his court cases. $71 million is what they had on cash on hand, the Biden campaign at the end of February. you know, about more than double what the Trump campaign had. Now, the Trump campaign says they expected to have raised about $33 million at a fundraiser later this week. We'll see what comes of that. There's also this Washington Post headline about how some of the billionaires, GOP billionaires, who weren't so happy with Trump now after January 6th, they're coming back to him. So we'll see if they decide to open their wallets and how much that changes things. Trump has taken some novel fundraising approaches also in the recent days. He's selling God Bless the USA Bibles. Of course, those gold sneakers, among other things, mugshot T-shirts and the like. How much difference is this going to make? Look, money always makes a difference. Yes. But there's going to be loads and loads and loads of money in this election. Super PACs are going to come in. They're going to spend a ton. How do you see that playing out?
I think the Trump voters coming, particularly the very wealthy Trump voters coming off the sidelines, is significant because it was a question of whether that was going to happen. Listen, if there are folks who liked the policies that the Trump administration put into play, they're not going to care about some of these other things. The question is, absolutely, what some of these very important blocks of voters do, because this is going to be a wash in money, mm-hmm. no matter what. Yeah. And I don't know that at the end of the day, how, unless it is completely uneven, it's going to matter in the presidential race.
It's almost like it's the operational issue, how campaigns are conducted, how they're dealing with things, such as putting an operation together in key battleground states. There was an alarm that was raised by the Michigan Republican Party chairman, Pete Hoekstra, saying, we've got the skeleton right now. We've got to put more meat on it. Okay, that's not necessarily where you want to be, but we'll see if that changes as they get closer to November. But then there's the question about mail-in voting. Democrats are succeeding in it. Trump has demonized it, and that has caused concerns among some Republicans, including Senate candidate Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania, according to an audio obtained by Politico. He said, every now and then we'll get asked about it. He did Laura Ingraham a couple weeks ago, referring to Trump. He said, I don't trust those mail-in ballots. And McCormick goes on to say, it's really hard to get our people for the mail. At the top of the ticket says, you know, so to make this work, he's got to come out and say so, according to McCormick, who is in that key Senate race. But there is a problem because the guy at the top of the ticket continues to say things like this.
Mail-in voting is totally corrupt. Get that through your head. It has to be. The votes, I mean, it has to be.
If you have RNC. Mail-in voting, you automatically have fraud. If you have
okay, well, there's mail-in voting in Florida,
that's
and
right.
You won huge.
That's right. If you have it, you're going to have fraud. Anytime the mail is involved, you're going to have cheating. You're going to have cheating.
I mean, that's the real problem for the Republicans.
It is, but the thing that Dave McCormick said, that's very common for kind of MAGA come lately candidates, is to say they don't agree with Trump on everything, but something or other happened in 2020. Let's move on to a different topic. The Democrats have an organizing advantage now. They have a money advantage. Their coalition currently is college-educated voters who love to vote. Look at this Alabama election on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. When there's a lower turnout race, Democrats donate money. She got, I think, 1,100 donations for a special election. But going back to these billionaires coming back off the sidelines, what mm-hmm. the Biden campaign wants to talk about, and what that would be a good hook for, they have right. trouble getting to do, is what are the stakes of the election? Who's going to be getting their taxes cut? Who's going to have their their Trump taxes extended if we lose?
Yeah.
It's those guys. It doesn't matter as much about the money because they want to get that conversation. What is the policy change going to be?
Sure. And we'll see if the mail-in voting in particular makes a difference. Right. Mm-hmm. Coming up, politics gets really personal. I hit the campaign trail where Republican members of Congress are trying to oust one of their own.
Come to these things and you ask questions that nobody here cares about.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life, lately we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
It has long been seen as a major breach of protocol, one member of Congress campaigning against another from within their own party. But in this bitterly divided Republican majority, things have changed. Now the leader of the hard right Freedom Caucus, Congressman Bob Good, is under siege. largely because of his role in ousting the last Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. It all speaks to the larger GOP feud that has left their agenda in tatters and tensions simmering. And as I found out when I traveled to Good's district in Virginia this past week, it has also become increasingly personal. The GOP civil war that brought down a House Speaker and roiled the Republican majority, now in a red district in rural Virginia.
This is where we will make our stand.
Where the leader of the hard-right Freedom Caucus, Bob Good, has been targeted by center-right Republicans who are pushing State Senator John McGuire's bid to knock off Good in the June primary.
Bob Good didn't come here to govern. He came here to be famous, and he came here to get Twitter followers and do all this stuff. Bob Good's wearing our jersey, and he's not on the team.
As he barnstormed through his district with fellow hardliners this past week, Good said he was battling fellow Republicans who are hurting the country.
Derek Van Orden said, you're more interested in being famous than governing. What do you say to those colleagues who are targeting you?
The people in the 5th District know who my colleagues are who are here today. They've never heard of Derek Van Orden. They could care less what Derek Van Orden thinks. Rhinos, establishment moderates do nothing to influence Republican primary elections.
That question setting Good off.
For you.
More stupid question?
I just want to ask you.
I'm serious.
No,
you come and you ask this.
I don't know.
Come and cut the camera off. I'll talk to you. I'm not going to talk to the camera right now.
I just want to know if you'll vote for the motion to vacate on Speaker Johnson.
Here's my point. You come to these things and you ask questions that nobody here cares about.
You voted to oust the Speaker of the House.
You bring up Derek Van Orden, which is a joke, because he should come campaign for my opponent, because nobody here knows.
It's part of the criticism you're getting, that's why.
Yeah, but you don't ask me about Matt Gaetz or Chip Roy or Mark
Meadows. I talked to all of them.
Good was one of the 8 in the GOP who voted for the unprecedented ouster of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. Now McCarthy allies are angling to knock them off.
How much do you think it has to do with Good voting to oust McCarthy?
Well, it has something to do with that, but more important than that, we've got a guy who will be a good member of our team.
Good's opponent, a former Navy SEAL, says he was not recruited by McCarthy, though he told CNN he spoke with the former speaker recently.
I believe that my opponent wants to burn it all down, no solution kind of guy.
So would you have voted to oust Kevin McCarthy?
I would have never in a million years partnered with the other party to take out our leader. If you are helping the Democrat team take out the Republican team, who's the rhino?
The feud, part of a larger battle over the GOP's direction. While many say they need to govern through bipartisan consensus, hardliners like Good push for a no-compromise approach.
I do not want to go back next January without Bob Good sitting there in the trenches with me.
We cannot let the swamp take out the chairman of our Freedom Caucus.
Good has also clashed over Pentagon spending with defense hawks, like House Armed Services Chairman Mike Rogers, who privately called Good a danger to our country at a recent fundraiser for McGuire. Still, Rogers and others targeting Good don't want to talk about it.
I am wondering why you're trying to defeat Bob Good.
I don't have any comment.
Why are you targeting Bob Good?
Why are you targeting Bob Good?
You don't need to run away. I mean, we don't know why you're targeting Bob Good.
Just want to congratulate and thank Governor Ron DeSantis.
Good has to navigate another landmine, his backing of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis over Donald Trump in the primary.
Mr. Good went against President Trump early. We can do a lot better than Good. We can do great.
Now his backing of DeSantis turned into an attack ad from a new GOP outside group.
Governor DeSantis gave us the opportunity for 8 years that we need. I think we need 8 years.
But Good is now aligning with Trump, even stumping with Trump's former chief, Mark Meadows.
Was that a mistake to endorse DeSantis?
Why don't you get with the president? This is a time to rally behind President Trump. My opponent wants to continue to divide people based on the past.
McGuire, who met with Trump recently, says of Good,
certainly he betrayed President Trump, and I'm a big Trump supporter.
Piling on, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a hardliner who endorsed McGuire and wrote that Good stabbed Trump in the back.
Nobody cares what Marjorie Taylor Greene says or thinks.
All as Good's allies have tried to ease tensions with Trump.
I've done all I can to explain to President Trump that his agenda will be executed to its best efficacy if we have Bob Good in Congress. In primaries, people fall in love. In the general election, they fall in line.
But this is a very, very personal Interparty fight. It is becoming increasingly more common in this House GOP. This is one of four that, at least so far, of primaries of these internal party feuds that are happening. But this is the one time where the center right is trying to strike back against a Tea Party, what you would consider a Tea Party congressman, but a hard right member.
Yeah, and you started that story with saying how unprecedented this is, that you're seeing a House GOP caucus, members of a caucus, go after another and try to have him out-primaried. But this illustrates exactly what's going on Capitol Hill right now. And there are so many times of revenge politics. We lose track of it, right? Mm. Everybody is trying to, there's knives out on this person. People are getting back, trying to get back at this person. And it's spilling out into the election. Mm. So I think that this is really a case of what we're seeing play out on Capitol Hill. Yeah. And it is interesting, too, because, okay, Bob Good is the leader of the Freedom Caucus. And if you think about that, that was actually started because it broke off from the other part of the caucus. Now you're seeing splinters and factions develop in what is a faction. So it's just showing you that There's so much division in the House GOP that's spilling out, not only for the Freedom Caucus, for the larger caucus.
Yeah, and before you jump in, yeah. Jackie, this all comes as the new speaker, Mike Johnson, yes. is facing his own threat to be ousted here. We have new reporting out this morning with my colleagues Melina Zanona and Annie Greer about how Johnson is trying to maneuver from this moment. He's dealing with the prospects of putting Ukraine aid on the floor. People are on the hard right are threatening to vote against him, oust him if he does move ahead with that. He's sounding out some key Republicans to try to figure out how to avoid this moment. In fact, he actually spoke to one key Republican about this, Matt Gaetz, who was central to pushing out Kevin McCarthy.
I would not support a motion to vacate. I gave the speaker some unsolicited advice that we've got to get into a fighting posture, and I was very pleased with how the speaker received that advice.
Do you think the speaker needs to be voted out of office?
I don't have a comment on that, you know, and I think that comment is a comment in of itself, but I don't have a comment on that.
You may have a vote to vacate Mike Johnson. Would you support that?
I mean, look, right now we got to go back and get Republicans united to point out what our radical progressive Democrat colleagues are doing. And present a actual competing vision. That does not start with, to be very clear, it does not start with putting a clean Ukraine bill down on the floor.
You have confidence in him as speaker right now?
Look, you know, again, we're all working together trying to figure out what we're going to do next.
A lot of these members are not there about whether they'll kick out Mike Johnson, but they're keeping the option open.
The only peacemaker in the Republican Party right now is the former president, particularly among House Republicans.
Donald Trump, the peacemaker.
I know, here we are. But no, among House Republicans, he's really the only person that they listen to. Mike Johnson doesn't have the clout to be a peacemaker. You saw him try to do that a little bit in some of the primaries, nudge some people out who they didn't think could win. But if you have to imagine, if the former president endorsed in this race, it'd be over.
I just wanted to point out one other thing about how personal this has become. You mentioned that Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's trying to push out Mike Johnson, right. and Bob Good, she's supporting Bob Good's opponent. Just listen to how Bob Good described his view of Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Nobody cares what Marjorie Taylor Greene says or thinks. And she's a one-man show. She's grandstanding. She wants attention. She's getting it from folks like you. None of us are talking about it, but you guys are talking about it. And so I won't predict what she may or may not do. Who knows?
He would not say, and obviously he doesn't think so highly of his congressman from Georgia. All right. Coming up next, a new appeal from Biden's team to woo Nikki Haley's voters as the president faces a new threat at the ballot box.
This particular issue on Gaza is breaking our coalition.
Existing condition allowed them to deny coverage. They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into Gaza.
It's a scene that's becoming all too familiar for President Biden. He continues to face major pushback in his coalition over his handling of the Israel-Hamas war, with pro-Palestinian activists demanding he take a much firmer approach with the Netanyahu government. And even though he has the Democratic nomination locked up, Biden once again faces a threat of protest votes in the Wisconsin primary on Tuesday and a warning in a key battleground state come November. Wisconsin, the perennial swing state, has 10 electoral votes up for grabs and is part of the so-called blue wall that Biden must once again win to keep the White House. But he does not have much room for error. Biden only won Wisconsin by about 20,000 votes in 2020. My panel is back. Just to get a sense of, remind viewers how close this was back in 2020, just look at the map on your screen. It was incredibly contested, this election here. It comes as Biden is facing these problems on his left. The uncommitted voters in the primaries in Michigan, Minnesota, and Washington State, significant amount of them voted for uncommitted, not for Joe Biden, despite him being essentially the only candidate here in this race. There is this group that is running this effort to try to stop or at least protest Joe Biden on Tuesday. This is one of the mailers that went out. And just listen to the ad montage that was these ads that have been put out in Wisconsin to convince voters to vote against Biden.
I and others are voting uninstructed in the Wisconsin primary because we're unhappy with Joe Biden's complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We as citizens of the United States of America cannot roll with genocide and slaughter of the Palestinian people.
If they won't listen to our calls or our emails or our letters, then they better listen to our votes instead.
The only thing we can do, it seems, is to send a message via these primaries.
I mean, how concerned should the Biden campaign be?
In the short term, this is probably the best thing that could happen to them, because these numbers underrate how unpopular Israel's war is right now with Democrats. You look at Gallup's polling this week. Since November, since people were reacting to October 7th, support for all Americans for this war has fallen off. It's in the 30s. Among Democrats, it was 18%. So you're not going to see Biden get 18% of the vote in Wisconsin. You have right now. And I talked to voter instructed leaders this week. They're people who do not want Donald Trump to come back to power. They want a change in policy. They want to pull every lever they can to get there. They don't want to be in the position, most of them, of voting for Cornel West or leaving their ballot blank or casting some other protest in November. So for right now, this they see this as an intervention, and that's how the Biden campaign reacts. I mean, you played that clip at the fundraiser. Stephen Colbert even acknowledged the protesters who kept heckling in the audience about Gaza and changed the question around to, okay, give us an answer to how this war is going to end.
Yeah, I mean, you made that good point about mm-hmm. how voters have changed their views about Israel and mm-hmm. Palestine, particularly on the Democratic side. But there were 31% more support for Israel's and for the Israelis over the Palestinians back in October. It's 31% more now. Back then, it was 50% more voters supported Israel over Palestine. They sided with them more. And more Democrats support the Palestinian cause over the Israeli cause at this moment. And this is what some of the members on the left who are concerned about the president's handling of this are saying about it.
This particular issue on Gaza is breaking our coalition. We need that fragile coalition to come back together. But this is a moral issue for people. And so there's not a lot of time to fix it. The worse it gets in Gaza, the harder it gets to bring people back in.
Worried that those voters could sit out in November?
Well, without question. If Donald Trump is the only alternative, absolutely. But it's an important message that shows that we need to use our bully pit to get something done on behalf of Gazans and the Palestinian people.
I mean, that's a strong comment from Pramila Jayapal. She says this particular issue on Gaza is breaking our coalition.
Yeah, you're seeing that through these protest votes. There is that distinction to make, that it's not necessarily that these folks who will vote uninstructed are going to be votes for Trump. But there is that question of how enthused they are about a Biden administration again. So the Biden administration, the White House will have to look at how many people are voting at this. The campaign, rather, will have to look at how many people are voting in this way, especially in a state like Wisconsin, where come November, it may be the state we're all watching. I was looking at a couple polls, and at least two of them right now are tied when it comes to Trump versus Biden. So that means that this election in Wisconsin, at least, could come down to, you know, just thousands of votes. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those protest votes that the campaign is certainly going to have to look at.
But Biden has taken a more firmer line against the Netanyahu government. Maybe not as far as those folks on the left want, but is his change in posture having any impact among that key voting bloc?
I think when you talk to folks in this movement, it's not enough because they're seeing, all the humanitarian disaster
that is unfolding in Gaza and what the administration can do at this point. I mean, you're right. I think that it's not enough at this point for those folks. Will they come back in November? Yeah. I think the Biden campaign is banking on that. Because the fact that they'll have Trump as their alternative, and that's what they're putting their hopes in and hope that they can do enough in the meantime.
Yeah, we'll see. It's a good question. All right. Coming up, we catch up with Trump's elusive former chief of staff. And on this Easter Sunday, how Trump's rhetoric is playing with a key part of his base, evangelical voters. Saturday Night Live actually had some fun with that last night.
What is that noise that comes from within? Look, the stone, it rolls away. Is it Jesus?
Basically, yes.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Religion and Christianity are the biggest things missing from this country. And I truly believe that we need to bring them back, and we have to bring them back fast. I think it's one of the biggest problems we have. That's why our country is going haywire. We've lost religion in our country. Christians are under siege. We must make America pray again.
Now, Donald Trump posted that video on Truth Social this past week while announcing he's selling new God Bless the USA Bibles for just $59.99. And the way he's talking about Christianity is no mistake. Despite all of his criminal charges, divorces, and hush money payments, the religious right, and particularly white evangelicals, continue to back the former president in droves. He knows it's an issue that motivates the base, as shown by the Republican pushback to President Biden acknowledging the Transgender Day of Visibility today on Easter Sunday, even though it falls on March 31st every year. Now, to talk more about Trump's appeal to evangelicals, I'm joined by NPR national political correspondent Sarah McCammon. Sarah was raised in the evangelical movement but grew away from it over time, and she's the author of a new book called Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. Sarah, good morning. Thank you for joining me on this Easter Sunday. It's so fascinating, Trump's hold with this segment of the Republican base. Just look at the exit polls from the first primaries here. Trump, DeSantis, and Haley. He dominated with this group, and he has been dominating with this group really since he first came on the political scene. What explains that?
You know, I think that there's a narrative that Trump hijacked the evangelical movement somehow, but I think that misses a lot. And it misses the fact that, you know, as we just heard, for years, Trump has been tapping into this longstanding narrative among evangelicals that America is in decline because it's moved away from Christianity, from this history when it was a strong Christian nation. It's moved away from that, and that is the source of America's problems. This is something he tapped into even with his motto, Make America Great Again, in many ways. Trump also has been a vehicle for evangelical policies. And, you know, I heard covering the 2016 campaign from a lot of people, including many evangelicals, that they faced a binary choice. They had to choose between two people that they didn't like very much. But as we saw with the exit polls from 2024, even when given other options, many white evangelicals strongly support Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, obviously abortion, he put three Supreme Court justices who voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. That goes a long way to this segment. But he has balanced. He didn't go as far in the primaries, Ron DeSantis. In fact, Ron DeSantis supported a six-week ban in Florida. That's something that Trump essentially criticized. And now he's floating a 15-week ban. How do you make of Trump's handling of this issue of abortion as he keeps this segment of voters on his side but tries to appeal to suburbanites?
You know, Trump's messaging on abortion has been all over the place, as you mentioned. He's at times criticized Republicans for seemingly going too far, restricting abortion after the fall of Roe v. Wade. But he's also bragged multiple times about being responsible for the overturning of Roe v. Wade, which it's true. Without Trump, Roe would very likely still be the law of the land. And evangelicals know that. You know, evangelicals are one of the groups that express the strongest opposition to abortion. And I think they see Trump as having delivered on that goal. They see him as someone who will continue to deliver on their policy goals. At the same time, as we've seen more and more abortion restrictions take effect, this is a political problem for Republicans. We saw that in some of the results from the 2022 midterms, and again last year with some of the votes where we saw a reaction to some of these policies taking effect. And Trump and other Republicans are well aware of that. So I think that's what explains the mixed messaging. I don't think it matters what Trump says too much about abortion, because
at the end of the day, Roe was overturned.
At the end of the day, Roe was overturned.
Exactly. So what's also interesting is just how he's dove into this messaging, messianic messaging at his events on religion and how that's playing with his base. So he posted on Truth Social about his one of his court cases, a picture of him next to Jesus. And then there's it's on Truth Social, he posted just last week a message from a follower. It says, "It is ironic that Christ walked through his greatest persecution, the very week they're trying to steal your property from you." And then even at some of his rallies, they play this video that he also posted on social media.
"And on June 14th, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, 'I need a caretaker.' So God gave us Trump. God said, 'I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, fix this country, work all day, fight the Marxists, eat supper, then go to the Oval Office and stay past midnight at a meeting of the heads of state.' So God made Trump."
What do you make of that?
You know, again, he's tapping into this idea that was present in my Christian school textbooks. This is something I write about, the idea that America's moved away from Christianity and it needs to move back or everything will fall apart. And so I think many evangelicals see Trump as a champion of their movement, even if he's an imperfect vessel, they might say, but he's someone who will advance their ideas.
Yeah, so fascinating. Thank you for diving into deep. That's just an absolutely fascinating dynamic. All right, coming up next, the once ever present Mark Meadows pops back up on the campaign trail.
And the next thing you know, CNN's showing up.
I want to thank Mark Meadows, who's here someplace right there. I want to thank Mark. I said,
what do you want to be? That was former President Trump on his last day in office, thanking his final chief of staff, Mark Meadows. Meadows, when he was in the White House, was a ubiquitous presence in Washington, keeping up relationships with former colleagues from his time as a congressman and often holding court with reporters on Capitol Hill. But he has been elusive in the aftermath of January 6th, having been ensnared in Trump's legal woes while facing his own criminal charges. Now, he was charged in Fulton County, Georgia, with racketeering as one of Trump's co-defendants in the election subversion case there. He pleaded not guilty. While Meadows was not charged in the federal election subversion case, it was reported last fall that he was granted immunity in order to testify before the grand jury in that case, and that he told the grand jury he did not think the 2020 election was stolen. Now, that news was met with ire from the former president, who took to Truth Social to suggest Meadows could have flipped on him. Now, Meadows has since been very difficult to pin down. He was once spotted on Capitol Hill back in October, though he avoided taking questions from reporters at that time. But this past week, Meadows finally popped up again in person in Virginia, stumping, as we saw earlier, for Freedom Caucus Chairman Bob Good in his primary. So I tried to ask him about his legal problems and that grand jury testimony.
Do you again? I'm not doing anything. Can I ask you about your grand jury testimony? Was it damaging to Trump?
TBD and when he's finally ready to speak out publicly. That's it for Inside Politics Sunday. You can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at MK Raju. You can follow the show at Inside Politics. And if you ever miss an episode, you can catch up wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Inside Politics. Up next, State of the Union with Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. Dana's guests include Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Congressman Mike Lawler, and Senator Raphael Warnock. Thanks again for sharing your Sunday morning with us. Happy Easter. See you next time.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.